And it has nothing to do with flattening hierarchies or empowering people to make decisions in their current roles in business design, or changing what we incentivize people toward, or even for that matter, creating better delegating and leadership of people externally. None of that. Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to thank our sponsor for Business Second Opinion, Guayaki. I have not been disappointed picking new flavors of guayaki. Have you guys tried Bluephoria? By the way, this is week two for me with that, and it is really good. We're also glad that Guayaki continues to brew their mate-based goodness through this challenging time. Mate, it turns out, contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. So it gives me the energy I want while also being a healthy choice. We hope you're going to check this great beverage out with your friends and family, and please let us know what you think. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. In the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, as you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, please stay tuned at the end of the episode. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Zach.
Okay, so Carol, you picked the topic this time. So for some background, we're going to do a bit of a dive into how organizations manage people, which we've done before. But my first question is how and why this one from the September to October 2020 issue from HBR, like why this one, right? So also for the folks following along at home, this article is titled Stop Over-Engineering People Management by Peter Capelli. So at first glance, it looks like, you know, we've covered this, as I said before, and you, Carol, wrote a couple books about it and who knows how many articles. So spoiler alert for me, this piece didn't really work out as from the perspective of me being a business owner. The author seemed to be saying, hey, look at all these new issues flooding into the business sphere, like the gig economy, algorithms that are determining work design and work design changes in response to COVID-19. All really, really important issues. But in response to all that, he basically looks at how we can mix Taylorism and behaviorism, almost literally quoted from the article, by the way, for how to solve these issues. But Carol, what did you get from this one and why is this new, right? Like, why are we tackling this one?
Yeah, well, you're right about that. We have looked at it before. The thing that amazed me was to see this, having seen it 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 15, every new era recycles these management theories. They don't even evolve them very much, as you could see. They would maybe polish them up a little. And that's really the point of doing this. Why for decades, even centuries, do all types, particularly these two models of organization managed keep showing up, the authoritarian and the empowerment, it's usually compared to or contrasted to. And why do they always miss the way humans really work? They don't get it. So I think the reason I wanted to bring it back and come at it in a new way was it breaks my heart because it actually limits human potential being expressed. It limits what organizations can do, and it actually limits life on Earth as we know it.
You know, it's interesting. I see what you mean. It's like no one's listening, right? And the author, so to give some a little bit more context here, the author alternates between what they call theory X, which comes from Taylorism, and theory Y, right, which comes from the beginnings of the human potential movement mixed with mostly behaviorism, without ever really attempting to consider a third way, right? It's like this is the only two things that exist, and you're going to have to basically pick from one. As a result, the article doesn't really move the conversation forward. It's honestly disturbing to see the author actually attempt to validate the aspects of the Taylorist approach here. It's like we've forgotten just how insipid it was. So he's definitely playing both sides of a pretty unsavory fence, ultimately leaving the reader with only two choices between humans being machines or needing to be rewarded in a way to keep them contributing so they can ultimately be docile for management. Okay, Carol, so more importantly than ragging on this article for the next half an hour or so, what can we do that might actually help that we've not already done so far with the podcast?
I want to answer that question, but I'm wondering if you would do one more thing, especially with the state you're in about it right now, and suggest what the article is saying do that they think is new, but so we really can compare it as we go along. I'm thinking of giving three principles about how humans work and compare it to these two alternatives and the compromise that they offer. Plus, maybe offer a little philosophy behind it that's never on the table in these conversations.
Okay, that's a good idea. Okay, so your theory here is that our listeners could use the principles you're going to lay out and test their thinking about how humans work. So they take each principle and attempt to reconcile it to what's on offer from the article. Then they can take a look and see if they're really thinking about humans as living beings rather than machines or rats. Am I following correctly?
You are. That's exactly what I'm hoping they'll do. Test this article and test anything they're doing, right now in their own way, trying to reconcile it. So my question again then is, what does this article suggest about how to handle what we're calling this ricocheting back and forth through history between these two approaches?
For sure. Okay. So as I read, this author, Peter Capelli, says, here's a bunch of new problems from the business world that we're grappling with. And here are the two dominant approaches to management theory, Taylorism and behaviorism. And so you should look at both and pick what you like and then give it a shot.
Yeah. And I gather you see some flaws in their argument. So would you describe what you see as the flaw in what they're offering?
Sure. Okay. So in some ways, the author could have started digging into some of these really important issues, right? But instead of pulling them apart to understand where they're coming from and how to grow people's capacity to engage with them, he actually offers ideas like, quote, it may be easier to ignore people, but we're still here, unquote, which is actually him misconstruing a quote from Kurt Vonnegut's The Piano Player. Which in the end, actually, it leaves me like doubly bummed out. I'm trying to get myself together here. But it's like he's bought into the idea that humans are in the way of a business's ultimate success and growth. And this is so backwards, I actually don't even know where to start.
Yeah, okay. So both of these philosophies of managing people are missing what you called a third way, at least a third and maybe some others, that I believe we can articulate some principles out of regenerative work design that we can bring closer to being aligned with the ontology of human beings. And ontology, really, we're talking about how it is that we come to be more of who we are, express that into the world, and therefore be able to contribute more. Plus, we're about to start a new community at Carroll Sanford Institute on how to build this nature of work design. I'm so fed up with these being the only two alternatives that get written up. So, Zach, can you track as we go along here and share your comparison with the HBR article as I offer these three principles?
Oh, definitely. I mean, they're missing a lot and they love working with comparisons. And I love working with comparisons as a way to build discernment. So what's the first one here, Carol?
All right. So let's start with the first error in the ideas offered in the HBR article is actually in the subject line. That is managing people. They get internal and external backwards. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. The principle I would offer is internal management inside of me and inside of you is more effective in producing outcomes on all measures than someone managing any one of us from the outside. In other words, having someone else, whether that's a supervisor, a parent, a teacher, any one of those or and a million others tell us what to do, how to do it, how well we did, gold star, or needs improvement, versus having us learn to do that for ourselves is just blatantly inefficient and ineffective. So I bet you could speak to your experience about that in your life, Zach.
Yes. Okay. So I've definitely seen this all over the place in my 20 years in the business world. So let's take healthcare, for example. So in recent years, managers, believe it or not, have actually started employing algorithms as models for nurses to follow to engage in the care of patients. So in other words, this symptom means this problem, which means this diagnosis, which means this care plan, which means this set of goals for the hospital of all things. So it essentially obliterates the ability to care for someone when you see them as a set of problems that need to be solved to free up a bed as soon as possible. It also leads to untold numbers of mistreatments because ultimately it reduces the complexity of a human situation to that of like a car that won't start that needs to get fixed. But Carol, this seems so obvious, right? Like, how did we get this backwards and upside down, and how do we fix that?
Yeah, I know. It pains me to listen to you tell that story. I think one of the things that gets us upside down is we humans seem to learn at a really slow pace. And our modern method, in quotes, of science, of research, is even slower. The science that we are using is literally at least 100 years old, and it always builds off of what we think we already know, and references old theory. So we build all of this into the algorithm that we're talking about, all these old theories. We don't start with a living science. A way of understanding life is what I mean by a living science, like a living human in a bed that has entered the hospital. And we never, ever get to how things work because we're starting with the science that is, you know, what do they call it? Dissection-based. Chop it up to understand it. Remember, medical students learn on cadavers. They aren't even alive. And they build on what they think they already know. When they write up the science, you have to cite all the references. And if you get too far out of bounds, your peer review throws it out. And there's some good reasons for that, but only if it were starting from the current a new way of really studying and studying life. But what we already have is we study existence. We don't study how something would be working when it's helpful. And we start with the metaphors, actually, of machines. And the metaphors of behaviorism, like how the brain works, is like a computer. And both are filled with old science. In fact, I was just reading another article before we got on explaining how neuroscience is going to revolutionize healthcare. But even neuroscience, just think about it, is studying the working of the human brain in slices using a machine on incremental behaviors where you break it apart and study one thing at a time. We're dissecting with neuroscience.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely lands from the healthcare world, right? And it's always about taking one initiative that's well-intentioned, but the solution always needs to show up in the form of an algorithm or it gets tossed out because it doesn't get recognized. Right. So Carol, how do we break this cycle?
Well, there's some things that are not as easy to see because people always think go train people or, you know, influence them somehow to change. But it's really all held in infrastructure, that which we can't see. So two examples of that are mental models, which we've talked about several times. They're what frame and hold the mind as fixed. And in it, what you see are people using the ideas they've always had. It's almost like an algorithm of the mind. So we have to see those mental models.
So by in my mind, you mean like mental models that frame what we see as possible, like using a framework where you can see different levels or approaches or something like that. Like, so we have to see the mental model and change it, right? But what do you mean by infrastructure?
Okay, so infrastructure is the idea of how you set up an institution to work. And that's like family. How does your family work? It has an infrastructure. Who's in charge? Who's on the bottom? Who gives gold stars? Who gets punished by whom? Educational institutions or who grades who? The workplace, who gets promoted? Who gets gold stars there? The military, church, and any other institution. For mental models, I really mean the internalized equivalent of being programmed, not thinking that as though thinking doesn't need to get included. We have to move just away from mental models to framework thinking, because frameworks tell us what questions to form or where to form them, and to do our own answering in that moment. Within your case, you were talking about healthcare with that patient in that situation. And other infrastructure, for example, are teams. Think about how ubiquitous teams are. They were not 50 years ago, but teams became organized the way they came out of the military. Were organized around functional activity, not who or what they were serving. So it's like an assembly line or a coding group and a shift that we all work on together. So that team forms an infrastructure for working, but it also becomes the infrastructure for the thinking, for deciding who decides, who gets to know what's important, who evaluates, and even how pay and promotion decisions get made. Do you see that at work?
Yeah. So the author actually talks about agile scrum teams here, which I think might be an example of what you're talking about. So in agile, you have a product owner, for example, who holds the vision for the product by liaising between the software development team and the always kind of amorphous, quote unquote, stakeholders. So even though this tries to be a step forward, it still displaces the connection to the user of the software away from the development team, often putting them at odds with the product owner. But Carol, what would be a different infrastructure then?
Yeah. No, that's a fair question. So I wrap primary teams around marketplace and specific fields out in that marketplace, like a customer node. So we don't have the primary team being the people on the line or in your coding group. It is people who come across the organization and are responsible for a particular buyer node. Those clusters are the beneficiaries. They have shared values and ways of making decision, which is another switch in infrastructure, because most teaming or most research is done from the infrastructure of demographics. And it's artificial, it's abstract based on, well, things like how old they are, what race they are, the number of children they have. And we need to move that to a concrete, living-based way of thinking. The buyers and teams can then be aligned to create reciprocity between them. What does this buyer or distributor need? What do we need to make? And that's of the people who are doing it. Further, you have a chance under those conditions to have a non-expert, non-authoritarian infrastructure, and instead have an infrastructure that's designed to build capability for people to be organized and self-responsible. And that means you take the entire evaluating process, like from ideation to decision-making to implementation and to evaluation. That's usually four different people in four different departments who are judging, usually some authority or hierarchical, judging others. And anyway, I call them the other authority. So maybe we should pause for a moment, talk about how this relates to that HBR article again.
Well, it's not even really addressed in the article, though. The author focuses strongly on lean management, right? The thing we talked about before, as a solution that's taking something from both worlds that he's talking about. And he likes it as a result. But this is all about productivity and quality and has nothing to do with customers and their lives. So in the end, it's all about, again, external motivation through rewarding people with, quote unquote, empowerment.
Right. So what we're talking about here is our first principle was that people do better self-managing if it's internally driven. On this one, we're talking about the second principle is really the organization does better when what we do is connect the infrastructure, the teams to the external world rather than to their other local team members. And the reason for that is when humans are emotionally connected to a beneficiary's experience, they can do, they will design a better approach than if an authority tells them what to build based on a survey. And I think that comes from that we're somewhat hardwired to contribute. I mean, we have mirror neurons. We have all sorts of ability to connect with others. I do agree that it's not well developed. But when it is, and I've watched it, for 45 years of my work, blossom, It can be. People can create. We can design teams that are wrapped around the benefit for the user, that second principle. Then their motivation will be high. It'll be tied to what's important. And with that principle, you start building capability to operate in a whole different kind of infrastructure. People often judge what I'm talking about based on the current infrastructure. They say, well, that won't work. You can't have them be responsible for customers. No, not the current infrastructure, because you haven't built one that's really based on how humans really work, that rather than how humans would be if we thought of them as machines or rats. So it's a capability restraint, not a who manages restraint. And it can be easily reconciled.
So the first principle is individual internal management exceeds outcomes in all measures to managing someone from the outside. So say again, what's the second principle?
Yeah. All right. So I hinted at that earlier, and it's the opposite in the reference to the first ones, where this one is about measures. First one's about managing. Who manages, the outside or me from inside? The second one is, what do we measure? And what we tend to measure is inside, what we do. And I would say that the principle needs to be external measures internalize all effects for the stakeholder system. So we usually measure everything at the point that something gets done.
Ah, right. Like the billiard ball in the pocket, like we talked about last time. The question here always being, did we get into the right pocket in the right order, and can we count it immediately?
Exactly. So that's like keeping your eye on the ball in the moment, ignoring whether you're even improving how you played the game or even ask if it's the right game to be playing. So we want to move from measuring at the level of the doing to measuring at the level of effects in the system we are serving. Another way of asking that is, what does the customer measure? What does Earth measure? We don't talk to her very often. What do communities measure? Do we even care? And what is the core contribution that we can make to helping that measurement happening for them? So it's not about measuring at the level of action, but at the level of the effects in the system.
You know, it's interesting because this would have us focusing more on our ability to see the effects on, like, say, climate or social justice or humans and businesses in general, where we're actually more likely to want to pay attention to the right things. So this actually brings us back to our indirect quantum way of working that we've talked about before.
Yes, and it also calls on the business to develop capability to work with all that, particularly, and we haven't talked about for a while, but the idea of external considering, which is different than internal, where I think all about me and the effect on me. We get better at looking at the effect on the other of our actions. So in the developmental infrastructure, things like pay and progression change completely so that teams are able to extend themselves into new arenas, be able to develop new ways to pay, new ways to grow, and they commit themselves to new effects for those external stakeholders and the process improvements necessary to do that. Not just process improvements, which they pointed out there were a lot of folks got in trouble with that. Instead, you start to really source the workers themselves, begin to source from a strategic plan that the business had that's tied to new, exciting stretch effects. Then they individually can initiate and commit to big contributions they want to make to a stakeholder. It, which are usually done in some program. The organization decides a few people work or you get a little part of circular, donut, sustainability economies. No, in that case, one small group designs and manages in some separate department. This new infrastructure I'm talking about makes it internalized in the way teams work because they're working on real stakeholders and individuals can take responsibility.
It's interesting because in the article, he actually talks about how the biggest issues that come up in an organization are because someone is getting paid more for the same title or position as someone else. So it seems like your approach actually indirectly resolves a lot of that.
Oh, it does. Pay and progression is so different. And we're not going to talk about that on a podcast at all. But it's going to be part of the new community we're building about how you build work designs that work from a quantum developmental infrastructure. So The third arena, we're up to the third pencil, is shifting paradigms, which you've hinted at several times here, to working from direct, hit the ball into the pocket with my cue stick, to working indirect. When we start to work indirect, we put in place what it takes to operate where you have external measures and internal self-management. We switch away from this external and internal continuum of which is really what this article is about. Does everybody get managed from outside and we measure from inside or the other end? Anything done in the external field of how the business works is about working indirect. So let me slow that down a little bit. If we're working on how we do business out in the world, whether we're working on mindfulness or we're working on being able to take on diversity, inclusion, social justice, or take on climate change, when we're doing that, most of the time, we're working indirectly into a field that we want to change from our business. It's not always, because sometimes people do carbon counting, but much of what we do out in the world to build the capability to help us change what we believe in and how we work can really start to move toward this indirect. The personal work, when you're doing it indirectly, becomes very concrete. So it's a different kind of direct. I can tell I need to say this a little better. Let me give an example. So if I have a customer and I know that they need capability to do something that our current way of working with them is not giving them, and I don't exactly know how to help them, if I build my capability to deliver for them, that's very concrete. It's a specific customer. But it's very different than direct. It's really guiding myself from within and unfolding in a developmental way. And when you do it that way, it's fully integrated by the individual into their own choices for all they do. It doesn't come at them from somewhere. And the thing that drove me crazy about this article is then they talked about balancing, you know, between these, do a little of this, a little of that. Nope. You need, with these first two new principles, the new infrastructure and new measures, you need a new kind of infrastructure completely, not a balancing between these two and a new paradigm.
Yeah. And I find that there's a reciprocal relationship between these two first principles, right? So from my experience of working on being self-managing, the first principle means I need to work to manage me rather than seek to manage my own shortcomings and others. The second principle means that the business measures external effects that actually internalizes the effects within the business. So the business ends up measuring what matters to those it affects rather than itself.
Yes. You got it. All right. So this requires a shift in mental models, that infrastructure we have in our head, right? Of who's in charge. It necessitates an infrastructure change. Like that includes pay and progression, hiring, teaming, performance, and everything else, the way it's designed. And it's why I finally felt like we just had to start this new community, because I watch even my well-intended clients, colleagues, even members, not getting that they have to actually shift the paradigm for this to work.
And it has nothing to do with flattening hierarchies or empowering people to make decisions in their current roles in business design, or changing what we incentivize people toward, or even for that matter, creating better delegating and leadership of people externally. None of that.
True. Instead, it has everything to do with changing all of the roles, changing all the philosophies. For example, supervisors don't get flattened and thrown away. You change how their role works and they no longer are the supervisioner. They are the resource to teams that are wrapped around markets. And those markets within, and those teams within them have people who initiate promises to specific customers, buyers, distributors within a node, another infrastructure change, and to a new type of investor, which we're going to look at in something called the regenerative governing body community. So what do you want to say now to this HBR author and the article he wrote and suggest how we all begin to rethink anything that we're reading and become more discerning about it?
I'd encourage people to take these principles, right, and read back over the article. And where do you see that it falls short? And for that matter, try another of your favorite business articles and, you know, taking these principles along with you to see what shows up there as well. Also, Carol, can you say more about what does working indirectly mean for our listeners?
Yes. Okay. So indirect, well, direct means you work exactly on the problem, the issue, the challenge, right? Indirect means you work ongoingly, like all the time, like all that problem issues out there, but you don't go work on it. You work on developing capability of people to see better, think better, and you do it with a ritual kind of sessions. Like our podcasts are a ritual kind of sessions. We keep, I call it the Chinese torture method, but with a good intended outcome. Here, when you're building capability, you're working on critical thinking skills and personal self-management. And those are not done kind of plugged into a meeting somewhere. Nope, they're foreground. That's why you come. Now, you work on things in the business, not lemonade stands, but the foreground is the development. Most of the time, we expect people to learn as a side effect. It's like they have some shortfall, some what they call a failure, and they learn something. Or they accidentally discover it because they're moved around from job to job. Nope. This principle is why we build communities, not networks, so people can come share ideas. Nope. They come to learn and development in community. And it means building new infrastructure that changes all the rituals in an organization so a different culture emerges. So we're working on capability, secondly, on culture. And you want your culture to become fluid in how it's designed in the context that you live in. And again, that is part of a ritual that is ongoing, not directly connected or working on any business agenda. So finally, what indirect means is it works on ensuring the capacity for consciousness and a greater and greater sense of that by how it is that you do business and how you particularly build reflection in and help people see things can exist in different worlds at different levels.
Carol, can you tell people a little bit about how to join a community to learn about what we talked about today?
Yeah, the best way probably is just to send me an email. You can go to carolsanfordinstitute.com and look under Managing Community, or I also mentioned the governing bodies. They're both under Carol Sanford Institute. But if you want to talk, send me an email at carolsanford.com. Let's remind people of the three principles. Management is about internal ableness for everyone to be self-managing relative to a strategy and to have internal locus of control responsibility for that.
Right. And measures are about external ableness to see our effects from an externally considering worldview.
Yep. And finally, the third one is business work design. Business decision making is about working indirectly with changing developmental infrastructure that requires people to think, to grow their personal capability, about shifting the culture by having developmental infrastructure and processes, and working on consciousness from reflection that's woven into all work that's done everywhere. That's how it really becomes something we integrate, not balancing between two pretty bad choices of optimizing mechanicalness and behavioral strategies. Well, folks, we have our virtual 2020 summit coming up November 17th. Its focus is on regenerative governing boards. So this is for all kinds of boards, paid, unpaid, advisory, directors, associations, and come and understand how governing is a universal process. It happens on November 17th. There's a web page that can give you more details, or you can email me. The web page is regenerativebusinesssummit.com.
And as always, the summit is for business teams, right? But we have communities for individuals to play in different roles than that. So communities for entrepreneurs, educators, change agents, economic shapers, and more. So if you want to learn more, check out Seed Communities, seed-communities.com.
And one request of you, we do need you. We need your articles. We need to know what business practices you want a second opinion on. We still send out second opinion mugs if we use what you send. And you can email me your idea at carol@carolsanford.com or businesssecondopinion.com, or you can go to Twitter where we have @biz_second_opinion, or The other way you could really help is donate, support our production cost, about $10,000 a year, on Business Second Opinion's webpage.
Another thing you could take a look at is joining a book club for The Regenerative Life that has an extensive workbook and live online workshops for free. You can find out more at carolsanford.com, and feel free to sign up for our newsletter so you can get connections about the show notes and much more.
And finally, thanks to Numi T. Thanks to Babson College for sponsoring the Regenerative Business Summit and Prize annually, and also for supporting the Business Second Opinion website and show notes for this podcast.
This has been Business Second Opinion.